Welcome, everyone. If you have interest in hearing from a guy who has raised over $80 million in equity and purchased over 3,000 units through syndication, you are going to want to hear from Venkat Avasarala. Listen to hear how he has pivoted, and his focus is now on adding another 3,000 units, but on the new construction side. Before we jump into the intro, I want to let you know about a couple conferences coming up. The Multifamily Investor Nation Summit, put on by Dan Hanford, is coming up on January 21st through the 23rd. It's a three-day online event for multifamily investors with over 1,000 attendees and over 50 speakers. I actually will be one of those speakers. Go to MFINsummit.com to grab your ticket and use promo code Darin, D-A-R-I-N, all caps, to get $100 off. Dan was on the show, episode 25, great guy and great event. The second conference I want to bring to your attention is a conference being held in Houston on February 27th, 2021, and is being hosted by Ferris Musa and Ben Suttles from Disrupt Equity and Kenny Wolf with Wolf Investments. All three of these guys have been on the show. Ferris, episode 11, Kenny, episode 24, and Ben, episode 28. Use code DISRUPT for your discount. Both great opportunities to learn more about the multifamily investing space. Hope to see you there. Now, on to the intro.
Welcome to Darin Batchelder's Real Estate Investing Show. Each week, you will learn how to grow your wealth through real estate investing. Be introduced to the players that are getting it done and learn how you can get involved. And now, here's your host, Darin Batchelder.
A little background on Venkat Avasarala before we start the show. Venkat grew up in India, obtained his bachelor's in engineering in India, and then came to the U.S. to study for his master's degree. He and his business partner formed Raven Multifamily and have acquired over 3,000 multifamily units. He is not slowing down one bit. In fact, he's looking to add another 3,000 units, but on the new construction side. Now, onto the show. Hello, everyone. So today I've got another special guest. As every week, I've got Venkat Avasarala here with me today. Venkat, appreciate you coming on the show.
Hey, thanks for having me, Darin.
Absolutely. So the way I know Venkat, so I met Venkat a while back. We were part of the same multifamily mentorship group. And I actually had his partner, Ramana Karada, on back in episode 5. And, you know, these guys have been doing great stuff. And so I'm excited to have Venkat on here today. So Venkat, just to start out with, for the listener's perspective, can you share how many properties and how many units you guys are currently invested in?
So we have done about 15 syndications. 13 of them are existing BNC class multifamily. Roughly 3,000 units. And then we have two more ground up construction projects going on as well, and about to start our third construction project soon.
You know, the way you just said that, it's so funny because, you know, coming in after you and seeing you guys were already successful when I came on board about 3 years ago, and you know, just hearing you say matter of factly, oh, 15 syndications, 3,000 units, you know, for the new guy looking to get their first or second deal, that just seems so far out of reach. And you, for you guys, you know, you blink and all of a sudden you guys are managing a ton of assets. So do you guys like pinch yourself sometimes?
No, not really. The pinching times are over. Now we're numb. So the very first deal, I mean, it takes quite a bit of time, right? Because you have to build that credibility. And of course, you need to have the know-how, get your ducks in a row, that kind of thing. And people can spot you, right? The lender, the investors, everybody, and even the seller, the brokers, everybody is looking at you, and they need to get that confidence that you are the guy that they want to work with. So it takes, it's a process. It's a process to get there. That's why the first or maybe the second deal will be the hardest. And after that, it gets a lot easier. And from that standpoint, your discipline, your processes, your procedures that you put in place will drive how much success one would achieve in this particular business.
That makes a lot of sense. One of the things that I was particularly fond of and you know, I admired what you guys have done when I got involved was, you know, there's a lot of syndicators that I've met, but you guys really did a good job of creating a brand. You know, you guys put together a company called Raven Multifamily, and you also were kind of out in the forefront. I think, you know, more people are doing it now, but out in the forefront in terms of using video.
Absolutely.
And using drones to do flyovers of the property. And so talk about, you know, what prompted that and you know, how'd you go about doing that? Because I feel like you guys were on the forefront. Other people have followed since, but you guys were kind of the first ones that I saw really going after it.
Absolutely. Like, you know, there is a saying, right? A picture is worth 1,000 words. Well, video is worth 1 million or 2, right? So when I started investing as passive investor, I invested a couple of deals in Dallas, which I was able to just drive by, see where it is before I wrote the check. But the third deal I invested was in Oklahoma. It's a 4-hour drive for me, and I didn't go there. I mean, sight unseen, I invested in it, but it bothered me, right, that I didn't get a good understanding of the locality and what's going on there. It's so much a video can communicate to you that you a sponsor wouldn't even bother communicating with words, right? So in my mind, video is the king, right? So we want to give that comfort feel. Again, we raised about $80 million, me and Ramna, never took one ad, never spent a dollar on advertising, because we believe that if you want to sell a $20 shaver kit, yeah, let's take ads on Facebook and everywhere and let's sell them, a ton of them. But what we are doing here is investing, and this is a private placement, you know, where we get to choose who we want to work with. So this is more relationship-based. So we focused our efforts in building those relationships and effectively communicate the opportunity to investors and have them use their gut feel. We still tell investors on the phone, use your gut feel. You know, you won't be wrong. Majority of the times you'll make right decisions. Use your gut feel. Listen to us, come to our webinar, listen to us, ask us a ton of questions. No question is a small question, big question, just that's our job to answer your questions. But then use your gut feel. And that worked wonders for us, where people see us that, you know, these guys are not, you know, using the boilerplate techniques to, you know, fear of missing out scenarios. You get a bunch of emails, right? So we don't do that. We send one email inviting them to webinar. And that's it. We don't send a bunch of emails sounding desperate and all that. Again, I'm not bragging. It's just that we give to our investors what we would like to see from other sponsors. And I think that helped us. And that helped us to get us where we are.
So talk to us about your annual goals. How do you set goals? And how do you stay focused on those goals? Because you guys keep upping the ante.
Well, that's true up until COVID. And then, you know, we kind of got into sidelines like everybody, right? It's not just us. A lot of people got on the sidelines and we're slowly coming back in. But up until COVID, see, what we realized is this, right? So when we got started, we met, me and my partner met at a Christmas party in 2015, exactly about 5 years back. And what we saw is that rapidly raising property prices, right? So we saw the writing on the wall. Hey, it may not be for years to come where we can buy these properties at 40 a door, 50 a door, 60 a door. So this is a time-bound operation, right? What is the goal, right? Both me and Ramna were very passionate about being financially free and also walk away from IT jobs, right? So be our own boss. So with that commitment, but at the time, we still have our IT jobs, right? So 8 hours of our day is spoken for already, right? So we have very limited time. So I remember us working way into 2 a.m., 3 a.m. just to get things done because we are very committed to our goal, which we met exactly 2.5 years from them. So July of 2018 is where we were able to walk away from both of our jobs.
Awesome.
We didn't expect that. We thought it was like 5 years, 6 years, 7 years, but we did. We kind of got ahead of ourselves there, and we felt very comfortable walking away from our job. So that was our goal, right? There is no other annual goals up until that moment. Well, now that we have able to walk away from our jobs, then we started setting up some kind of a soft goals, right? Again, we want to be very cognizant on what we are getting into. We don't want to buy a problem, right? Because there's a bunch of them outside, right?
Right.
So there's a lot of learning. I wouldn't say a lot of goals, but we focused on learning, right? How can we learn from that particular gentleman who has owned 10,000 units and watch the sharks, if you will.
Right.
You know what? To learn from the sharks because they got to be doing something right, which got them where. So we focused more on learning rather than just going after properties. But by the time we have already proven quantity, we showed that we are trustworthy people. We say what we do and we close the properties when we said we would. And we are easy to work with, even if something goes side to side while we are in contract. So once we have that reputation, we had brokers actually bringing up the property rather than us chasing them. And it was great. It was a great relationship that we enjoyed with everybody involved, the lenders, the brokers, the investors, and the whole nine yards.
That's fantastic. You know, that's a huge inspiration to many because that's a goal for so many people is, you know, hey, you know, can I do this while I'm still working? And, you know, can I build this up and then eventually be able to, you know, make the shift to full time? But how do I do it when I'm still working? And, you know, I get that question a lot and I point people to other, you know, examples like yourself. But, you know, when I came in, you guys were already rocking and rolling and you already had the reputation. You kind of sometimes forget that, you know what? Okay, now they manage 3,000, you know, they've had 15 syndications and raised $80 million. But, you know, at some point they were going after their first deal too. And they were both working and having to do it on the side. So, you know, you had to have the determination, the perseverance to get that those first two done so you can create that momentum.
Absolutely. And what I would say for this is, so I came to United States from India. I'm originally born and brought up there, completed my undergrad in electrical engineering over there and came to United States in 2002 to pursue my master's degree. So I came to this country for American dream, obviously, right? Complete my master's, get a job, get a house, the two cars, a dog. That's the thing. It's an American dream.
White picket fence.
There you go. Yeah, just to complete the whole set, right? So that's all my expectations were, right? I have no idea what people talk about of financial freedom, retiring early. What is this, right? The old school, my dad, he worked till his retirement age, right? I mean, and he graduated out of engineering college. He was a civil engineer and he worked for state and he did the job for 35 years. And there's no other job he have done. So that's my mindset, right? Coming out
that's
of-
That's what you grew up with.
Yeah, yeah. And, but then what happens is like, look at where we are. Everybody's talking about like, you know what? We got to be financially free. Don't love your company too much. They may not love you back at some point, right? These kind of the theories started coming out. The mindsets, if you will, started coming up. And thanks to this advent of the technology, the ideas are spreading like wildfire, right? I mean, you're able to infect with these ideas into people's minds. So when the very first time when it occurred to me back in 2006, 2007, actually, that we got to be financially free, can't depend on job. What we are pursuing is something unnatural, right? Something very unnatural because that's not how the world is thinking, right? So if you want something which is not natural, so you have your effort should be the same, right? You cannot put just regular efforts, go work on it once in a while. You basically have to pursue it and hustle. Because what you are asking is something that 99% of the population in the world or the country doesn't have, right? So you want something extraordinary, so you have to put your effort should be extraordinary as well. And that is what I would say. And you don't have to do it for the rest of your life. I mean, we started 2016, by 2018, July, 2.5 years, I was juggling both the job and this thing. And I, in those 2.5 years, I took a few vacations, but 2 week vacations here and there. But other than that, I didn't take my wife to dinner. We didn't go to movies. I didn't watch much TV at all. So a certain sacrifices have been made for a short-term pain for a long-term gain. So that's what I would say.
That's a great point. I mean, a lot of people want to be financially free, but there's sacrifice, there's determination, there's perseverance, there's grit that has to take place to make it happen. But to your point, you don't have to do it forever. So it's just, you need to make a commitment. You need to maintain focus and go after it for a certain period of time until you start building that momentum.
Absolutely.
So talk to me about, you know, this is an interesting thing, and I haven't asked anybody this before, but tend to find a lot of engineers in this industry. And a lot of engineers, a lot of people on the technology side. Why do you think that is?
Engineers cannot help themselves, but to dig into things, try to understand, take it apart and fully understand it, analyze it. So these things come naturally to engineers, I guess. I mean, that for me, it's what it is. I mean, it's the curiosity. So my story was in 2007, I was driving to work. I was working here in Plano client side, who's a large a Fortune 500 company.
Sure.
So 9 a.m., I show up there, and then there's emergency services and all that. And it was like, what's going on here? So as I parked my car, and as I walked toward the building, I started to hear cries. People are crying there, some commotion. There's something going on there. But again, remember, this is actually a large Fortune 500 company, right? And what I figured is that on that day, they were doing it. It's October, actually. I remember it's October 2007. And that is when they were doing these layoffs.
Oh, right? Wow.
So they're doing these layoffs, and they're laying off these people who've been working for that company for 30 years, working on some outdated mainframe technology. And the reason why they're crying is they don't know anything else except for that piece of software they've been working for 30 years, and the world moved on, right?
Right.
And their fear is whether I can land another job at that stage of life, right? And probably they have kids in college. So I never saw that kind of scene. I mean, that was the first time I'm exposed to something like that. And when I saw that, it made me think, can that happen to me? Of course, right? I mean, when you see an adversity, I mean, you cannot help but thinking, can that happen to me? I was what, 27 years old back then, but can this happen to me? Well, it can. In this country, it certainly can, because we are a capitalistic society. And unless you work for state where you have some job guarantee, but outside the state, I mean, there's no job guarantee, anything, right? I mean, anything can happen. So then I determined, you know what? I'm not going to let that happen to me. Right, that is what got me thinking, okay, how else I can produce income which will support my lifestyle? I don't want to turn off my Netflix, increase my thermostat in summer. Just
now, right? Save your way to wealth. Right.
Exactly. So I want to, then it dawned upon me that I should work on something. Yeah, I still need the job, but, you know, I want a cushion, you know. And that is how I started single family, single family investing. And I invested about 20 properties, but it's not scalable and a lot of work, which I didn't mind doing at the time because I didn't have anything else. But once I got exposed to multifamily, I started divesting out of my single family, and I'm a multifamily guy right now. And what I would recommend investors is, hey, first of all, don't do anything which is out of your comfort zone, even though you continue to strive increasing your comfort zone, so to speak, right? But, you know, don't try to put a 250-unit property under contract when you have absolutely no experience, no partners who have that kind of experience, right? So that's what I'm talking about.
So I just want to I don't know if the challenge is the right word for that, but in my experience, every piece of it is, you know, scary and it's out of the comfort zone until you do it. So I understand your, you know, perspective on don't try to go out and do a 250 unit deal by yourself. You're just not going to be successful. But, you know, if you haven't bought a single family house or a duplex or, yeah, or a 100 unit property, there's going to be things that you're going to have to get uncomfortable with to do that.
Absolutely. Again, what I believe is being under constant stress is not the way. And that stress comes because in mind, you know that you didn't do what you're supposed to do to be here on that particular day. So what I wanted to say to your listeners is, yeah, keep extending your comfort zone. That has to happen, right? If you always want to be in comfort zone, it just won't work. You cannot get there where you need to be and get these extraordinary benefits,
right,
that we crave for, which is financial freedom, being your own boss, you know, laid back lifestyle and that kind of thing. So what I would say is like, just incrementally, continue to incrementally get there. And that's exactly how I did, right? The very first property I bought was a foreclosure and I bought it for $50,000. I ended up selling for $200,000 several years later.
Crazy.
But the stress I went through in buying that one property, I was sweating it by the morning I got it. But hey, in my defense, I was 27 years old, yeah, and I didn't have a lot of money saved up. And whatever I have, most of that money I'm putting into that deal. And I was sweating. I was sweating in the morning. It was like, what's happening? What's the stress, right? So know yourself, challenge yourself, but set realistic targets here, but keep working on it. It's a hustle. But now, then later in my career, we bought $28 million, $30 million properties, and we didn't think much because we know, we trust our judgments by the time. We believe ourselves. We know that we got all our ducks in a row. We did all the due diligences and everything.
Well, there's something that is I've heard a lot from a lot of large syndicators. And I want the listeners to think about this because, you know, when you start getting to 3, 5, 7, 10 syndications, you know, you still start understanding how to do it and you build processes and procedures and you're doing much larger deals and you have much less fear. Then it's funny when I talk to people about, tell me about your first deal, whether it was a single family, a duplex or multifamily. And that's the one that people are almost the most afraid of was because they're taking that first step into a world that they totally don't know. And, you know, get educated. But at some point, you know, you were sweating it, but you took action and it benefited you. If you didn't do that one single family deal, you know, you may continue to analyze forever, right?
Absolutely.
So that's something that I think a lot of listeners have to take into mind that it's scary, man. The first time you do it, the first time you do it, it's going to be scary, but eventually, sometime you're going to have to pull the trigger.
Absolutely. You do. You do. And you wouldn't believe that the second deal, which I bought a second house, which I bought another foreclosure that I bought 3 months from that point, it was so easy. Like, I mean, I didn't obviously sweat anything at all, but I felt so natural doing that because, hey, it's over. The learning process is over.
Yeah.
But what I want to tell is like some people just get stuck at that first step.
They do.
Take risks, but calculated risks. But you got to take risks. You have to believe in yourself, go get educated, and grow from there.
Look, I was even scared to make my first passive investment. So I wasn't even managing the deal, right? But I remember when I wired money, I was like,
I know.
I was like, holy cow, did I just like, am I going to have to explain to my wife that I wired money to some, you know, fake account and we lost the money. And I had done all my due diligence and, you know, I knew the people who were the sponsors and had talked to other people that had invested with them, but I still was scared that first time.
Absolutely.
And afterwards, you know, the second and third and fourth time it was a piece of cake, yeah, you know, but
absolutely.
Hey, so talk about something that's, I've seen a, a shift kind of in mindset with syndicators, and want to get your perspective on this. So I just got involved in multifamily real estate like 3 years ago. And, you know, the people that I surrounded myself, including yourselves, were focused kind of on the BC value add, 1960s, 70s, 80s product, and you know, workforce housing. You know, coming up to COVID and through COVID and, you know, where we are today, I've talked to a lot of syndicators, and more are looking to kind of trade up. So they're looking to, you know, get out of the C's and get into B's and A's. And so I wanted to get your perspective on, you know, are you guys focused there also? Why do you think that people are doing that? And just, you know, share with the listeners your perspective.
Absolutely. I'll share you my mindset, right, on what's going on this year ever since the COVID hit. So when we started this business in 2016, the very first property we bought was $35,000 a door, right? And then it's 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, 90s, and the last property that we bought was $102,000 a door, right? So you see how tremendously it moved the B and C class from 35,000. And these are just 2.5 years apart,
yeah,
right?
I mean, it's not crazy. Like
20 years apart. So there was a rapid appreciation which happened between these two timelines, right? So it was, so when we were buying at $50,000 a door, there is a lot of cushion, right? That can go wrong. Property management can mess up. Still, it's okay. There's just enough margin of safety in there where you don't have to sweat too much. But when you pay at that $100,000 and all that, so what happens is your margin of safety is thin, razor thin. If your property management mess up, before you know, well, you're tracking sideways now, right? So you're no longer on the pro forma. So that's one aspect, right? So that this is even before COVID, right? This got nothing to do with COVID, right? Margin of safety absolutely decreased. Now, what are we signing up for managing a B and C class property? Who are our tenants? These are the folks who make between household, not the person, right? Anywhere between $30,000 to $60,000, right? So these jobs usually doesn't need a college degree and maybe have to do be in person, right? So affordability was always already in strain. While the property prices increased from $30,000 to $100,000, the rents didn't magically go from $700 to $1,400. It didn't, right? So what happened is with all this, the affordability, the tenants are at strain because now we keep asking more rent every year and they're already stretched thin. And owners, we are strained because, you know, the margin of safety is shrinking. So even before COVID, it's a tough business to as we work towards the COVID. Well, COVID come and showed what's obvious to us, right? So now a bunch of people lost their jobs, and the people, majority of the people who lost their jobs are our C-class and B-minus or B tenants, right? Because these are the people who couldn't work from home like you and me.
Right.
And last time in 2008, when the recession came, we lost 8 million jobs, but it was very spread out. I mean, nobody shutting down our restaurants or nothing, right? So everybody felt the recession. But now, if you see, only the lower end of the income scale people, they are the ones who almost taking 90% of this brunt.
Right.
And they'll continue to do so for years to come. Because last time we lost 8 million jobs in 2008, it took us 5 years to get them back. So it was very painful. And now we lost 25 million jobs and we got 14 million easy jobs back, right? But the remaining 11 million, we don't know when they're going to come back.
Right.
So there will be a sustained pain with our tenants who live in a B and C class properties. If they don't have money, they cannot give it to us and we cannot distribute to our investors. So now you have to be very open about it, right? So we know what's going on and this pain is going to be there for a while. And now, do you want to cater to the demographic who's hurting? Do you want to build your business and you want to take your investors' money and put that where and trying to cater to these kind of people? Or do you want to cater to people who are doing relatively well? But if you look at it, the stock market is all-time high. Bitcoin is $20,000, right?
Crazy.
Right. Real estate is all-time high. So what does that tell you? There is a lot of liquidity. It's not like 2008. 2008, we didn't have liquidity. Right. That's why they were selling houses at $30,000, $50,000 or these 2,000 square feet houses. But now there's plenty of liquidity, both in the institutions, government, people, everywhere. So that's the good thing. So that's why there is a flight for safety where everybody wants to buy something in a nice area, class A, if at all possible, and do things that way. But my issue with that is, how can we generate this 15 IRR that an average retail investor look for managing a class A property?
Right.
Now, if you want me to underwrite it, I will underwrite it and show it to you. But if you ask me to deliver that, that's a whole different ballgame, right? So, and also everybody's thinking just the way we are talking right here. This is what everybody's thinking. So they're getting all these properties bidded up. Anything which cash flows is prime target for investors. Because like I said, there is no scarcity of liquidity here. Everybody got money. I mean, Fed made sure of it, right? And printed so much money and injected into the economy. We're flush with cash, everybody. So they're all-
And there's more coming, right?
There's more coming. So we don't have to worry about cap rates expanding and all that for a little while now. But now you have to worry about, on Excel, there's this deal, let's say in Houston, somebody's projecting a 10% cash flow. Is it really going to happen? I mean, you got to ask yourself these kind of questions, right? Because everybody's chasing these deals and they're getting bidded up. And like we discussed, the margin of safety is already razor thin. And that's even before COVID, right? More so in class A properties because the rents are not pretty high just because it's a class A property. There'll be another $200 more than a class B property in class A, but they're much more expensive. So my state of mind right now is not to tie up just with multifamily. Do what makes sense, right? Do what gives you most margin of safety, right? Do what gives you more favorable risk to reward ratio. So that is what I'm after, right? I no longer am married to B and C class properties, multifamily properties. Rather, I want to pivot from here and reset our criteria. If before COVID, if you ask me my criteria, I would start something like that. Oh, I'm looking for B and C class properties, 100 units minimum. No. That's not the criteria anymore post-COVID. If you want to invest for success, you got to think that show me the investments which has this higher, show me the business plan which allows me to see a favorable risk to reward ratio. Right. So what that means is single family is super hard. Not saying that I'm going to start flipping single family homes, but I want to get involved in that space. Austin, the prices went up 11%. Phoenix, another 10%. I mean, they are on fire everywhere. They just cannot build enough single family. And even hedge funds like BlackRock are allocating billions of dollars to go and buy the single family. I mean, I'm nothing before BlackRock. Right.
Not today.
Right. Not today. So definitely that's one space I want to get involved. And the second thing is construction. So again,
why construction?
Absolutely. Great question. Let's take two sponsors. One is a cash flow investor, right? Goes syndicates for and operates for cash flow. And the second is a developer. Now let's see how their lives are right now, right? So let's talk about the syndicator who invests for cash flow and all that. So we described how hard is it to land a deal, which makes sense, pay a decent price, deal with all the eviction moratoriums, deal with city and deal with the high delinquency. So right now it's pretty tough, right? Not many people openly say that, but we're going through some stressful time right now managing these B and C class properties. And we just talked about how hard is it to make the numbers work for a class A property, even though we have much more even though they're much more easier to manage. Now, if you want to stick with these B and C class properties, right, they're getting expensive every year. People are paying more and more and more for this so-called cash flowing property, and they're just killing this cow. If cash flow is a cow, they're just killing it, right? So paying more and more and more. So unless you want to invest something with a speculative nature, like where you don't care about cash flow so much, you buy something and you just wait. Yeah, project something, whether you hit or not, you'll definitely do well, probably, right? Somebody will come and pay you more than what you pay. If that is okay, be honest, be open to your investors. Nothing wrong with that. I have several people seen doing that. Then do it. Buy it for that reason. But don't think that you'll be able to produce this 8, 10% cash flow. That's not going to happen, right? Not at this time. So that is how that life is. But let's look at developer, right? So developer, they're doing the exact same amount of work. Nothing much changed other than lumber price going a little bit up, appliances with this trade war becoming hard to get to. Other than this few things, 10 years back, what the amount of work they're doing, that is exactly what they're doing. There's nothing changed in their life. But back then, they were compensated at 7 cap rate for what they, I'm talking about Dallas market here, right? At 7 cap rate, 10 years before, if they build a 100-unit building, they produce $1 million income, okay, here's your 7 cap rate, let me buy this off you. But right now, people are paying them 4, 4.5.
Right.
So they're doing the exact same work that they were doing 10 years back, and now their life is a lot better. They're getting compensated twice as much for the same exact work and at ridiculous cap rates because there is this insatiable demand from institutions inside the country and outside the country as well for this Class A properties. So I want to be on the side where things are getting better for the time being, right? And that's the skill. I mean, if you develop, I mean, it gives you a lot of satisfaction. Obviously, the IRRs are more, but obviously, you know, you cannot produce that cash flow on day one. And also, you don't have the depreciation on day one. So
one thing that, you know, when I was back before COVID hit and, you know, in the last year, you know how syndicators are, everybody kind of talks about what's going to happen in the next, you know, we're late in the real estate cycle and nobody knew what was going to cause the recession, but, you know, something was going to happen and how were multifamily going to perform. And, you know, the consensus that I had heard and I bought into it was, all right, well, if we go into a downturn, the bottom 20% of tenants in A properties are most likely going to flow down to try to save money to go down to the Bs. And then the bottom 20% of the B property tenants are going to flow down to the Cs. So, you know, everybody might be hurt a little bit, but that should flow down. But to your point earlier, that's not what happened with COVID. You know, it really impacted the C class and maybe B minus class. And, you know, for a few different reasons, one being, you know, people that are in higher paying jobs in A's, they were able to work from home, like you said, and they also have some savings,
absolutely.
So, if they lose their job, they know paying the rent is important. They need a place to live. And so they're most likely going to, you know, use some savings to pay. And most of those tenants did not lose their job. But in the C properties, you know, restaurants, hospitality, you know, hourly paying jobs, they either lost their job or had their hours cut back, and they don't really have the savings. A lot of them are month to month, you know, paycheck to paycheck. And so that's, you know, one of the reasons why this was, you know, played out a lot differently than a lot of syndicators had thought.
Yeah.
The other thing that we didn't talk about, but, and I think one of the reasons why people are moving to A properties is that it used to be that there was a good spread between the cap rates on A versus B versus C. So if a cap rate was, you know, 4.5% on an A, well, then maybe it's 6% on a B and then 7, you know, on a C. So there was a spread. You were buying an older asset that needed more work, had more maintenance, had a lower tenant profile, but you were also buying it at a higher return rate. And as the Dallas market, and actually I talked to syndicators all across the country, and to your point, I mean, people have just flooded the multifamily market and pushed cap rates down. B and C cap rates are almost on top of A's now.
Absolutely.
So why not have a newer property with lower maintenance, you know, if you're getting the same return?
See, if your equity is happy with a 10 IRR, let's do it. There's no two ways about it. Let's go buy up all these A-class properties and manage them and with relatively don't feel the pain at all. But if your equity is looking for higher IRRs, that is the problem.
I mean, which they are.
Which they
still are. Right?
Which they are. So, I mean, unless you do some magic on a spreadsheet, it's hard to project a more than a 10 IRR. And another sobering fact here is Class A, even though it's the same 5 cap rate in B, C, everywhere, but if you look at the rent growth and all that, you will see more rent growth again back in B and C just because there's so many people looking for B and C properties than A properties. It's simply right. A lot many tenants are look for B and C than A. And another thing, almost all the supply which is coming everywhere is Class A. So we are not building new Class C properties, Class B properties. We are only building Class A properties. You just cannot build any Class C or B property with the way the construction expenses are. So if you project 5 years out and not just make your decisions on the day that you're buying it, hey, it's the same 5 cap rate, C, B, and all that. So let's buy an A. But what happens 5 years out? Which class rents are expected to grow? Right? So you got to pay attention to because you have to look at the overall return of the deal. But on the B and C side, even though in the short term, I wouldn't even say short term, it's medium term, right? Over the next 3 years or so, the pain will endure. There's no doubt about it. Another sobering fact is in America, 51% jobs are comes from, or even I'm just talking about Texas, 51% of the jobs are created by small businesses. And most of these small businesses, now I'm talking about five to 50 people kind of thing,
right?
Employees kind of a jobs. And most of those live paycheck to paycheck, if you will. Not so paycheck, but from month to month, right? They take revenue from this month and pay bills from the last.
A lot of small businesses basically are you know, they're buying a job. You know, they're the main component.
But they are the ones who create majority of the jobs.
Right.
But now they're toast with this continued shutdowns and the impact from the COVID. And once these things go down, they cannot snap up just like that. See, airlines, they shut all the flights and they got some stimulus money. Boom, they open the doors. And that's okay for them, right? I mean, they can snap back up and hire every person that they have laid off just like that. Small businesses can't do that. They're gone. Right. And if they file bankruptcy, they will not qualify for any loan for next 7 years. So that job creator is out of circulation for the next 7 years. So it's a much sobering fact that we have to pay attention to on even the BNC. It's not a cakewalk. Right. I mean, all these jobs are gone and it takes for a while for them to come back. The easy jobs came back, but the real service level jobs, it's going to take a while for them to come back.
Your camp that, you know, look, we're going to have probably another stimulus package. We are going to have another stimulus package. It should be coming out anytime. And then Joe Biden said he's, you know, it's just the beginning. He's going to come out with more. But, you know, the big question mark is what's going to happen after those run out and there's going to be permanent unemployment. And how does that impact the economy? And how does that impact, you know, at these different asset classes, including multifamily? One of the things that is difficult to really factor in is the migration of people from, you know, with other states to Texas and other attractive markets such as Arizona and the Carolinas, Tennessee, Florida. You know, so what, you know, what I'm seeing is, you know, we have some tenants that may be struggling. If they leave the property, we have a, you know, a line of people that want to move in. You know, occupancy is not the issue. There's people that are moving into the state that need a place to live. And in my mind, you know, what I love about Dallas and Texas in particular is that incoming migration and the affordability, even though there's been a run up in the Texas markets, you know, if you look at the coastal markets, we're still extremely attractive, you know, in terms of a cost of living. And so my thought is that there's going to be a squeeze. Like we're never going to be the same rent as, you know, San Francisco, but you know, the gap between, you know, the West Coast and East Coast and Dallas and Austin and is going to squeeze over time. And so, you know, will that help the performance, you know, is the big question mark, because that's very difficult to forecast into the pro forma.
So look, when we talk about multifamily, we talk about population growth, job growth, but where is the wage growth, right? So where is the wage growth? There, it's non-existent. And if you book a 0.1%, it'll make the headline news. Hey, you know what? We booked a 0.1% of wage growth compared to last year, right? I mean, that's the state. So when we are increasing rents, let's say from $1,100 this month to $1,200, the same person who's living there can no longer afford it. They won't get that kind of rent bump, a salary hike to afford our rent hike. So we are expecting that this person will move away and some other person will come into Texas or Dallas who makes a little bit more money than the old tenant. And now that person is going to pay us.
They were paying $2,400 in California and now they come and they're like, oh, I'll pay the $1,400. That's cheap.
Absolutely. As long as we get that in migration, it helps. And I think rents will continue to increase. But it's my opinion that at some point it stops, right? And it slows down. It may not stop completely. Maybe we'll get the 2% rent growth for over the next 5 years. Maybe we will see that 6% rent growth that we have seen in 2000.
At some point, it's got to give, and that's what. So I've been in the loan trading business since 2002, and I was living in South Florida, and I told my wife, I said, you know, look, at some point, this is in the Great Recession, 2002 to 2008 kind of run up. I said, look, it just doesn't make sense, you know, housing prices. In good markets like Florida, they were going up like 15% a year. But to your point, incomes were only going up like 3%. And at some point, something's got to give. And, you know, that may very well happen here, or the migration of and population, incoming population may offset that. I don't know the answer to that.
Investors' expectations has to dial down. The 8%, 10%, 12% cash flow. One of these deals that we still own, we paid $66,000 for that. I recently sent 13% distribution to investors. Those days are gone, right? I mean, if you buy something today, there is no 13%, right? So your expectations has to be reset. And one trend I'm seeing, and in particular with Austin and Dallas, is where people are moving money out of their assets from both the coasts because of the business unfriendliness or whatever. I keep hearing that people just come here, just look a couple of units and say, okay, you know what? I want to buy this $40 million property. I just want to be out of California, right? So with this kind of investor behavior, what will happen is Dallas and Austin will continue to emerge as a safe haven for capital. Not so much for cash flow, but safe haven for capital. And every next guy is expected to pay slightly more than what this guy paid, and without much emphasis on financials and all that, right? So I think we need to expect that. Dallas is a great, provides the stability, the diversification of jobs and all that. It's becoming a safe haven for capital and all this more.
That's really interesting. So... And I haven't talked about that before. So, look, you know, Dallas and Texas has always been pitched as, hey, you can get good cash flow and cap rates are attractive here compared to the coastal markets and, you know, South Florida or California or, you know, Northeast. But I haven't had anybody present that to me before, that maybe the Texas markets start moving to be like some of these other markets where, you know, people park their capital and there's less cash flow. The cap rates are that much lower, but then they bank on the appreciation down the road.
And that's not completely bad. It's just that you have to know getting into these kind of properties that this is not cash flowing properties. We are soon will be a gateway market, just like how San Francisco is, where people will own for the heck of owning it.
Right.
Now, the question is your equity partner, shares the same kind of vision that you are saving and is going to play along,
right?
I mean, there should be some cohesion between how your equity is thinking and you are thinking. And if that there's a match, let's go ahead.
Right.
And another thing which we have to pay attention, which we didn't care about quite a bit, Texas is blessed with no income tax.
Right.
Awesome. We all love it. But a lot many people who doesn't know this is that our property taxes is one of the highest in the country. Texas balances its budgets. They don't do deficit spending. They have a $10 billion slush fund, which is all good, conservative, fiscally conservative principles, which made Texas what it is. But on the flip side, you do have to understand that you have this huge property tax bill, which is due every single year, whether your rent goes up or not, whether your tenants pay you or not. And insurance is another thing,
right,
which one of the highest in the country because of this constant weather-related incidents. And hurricane doesn't have to hit Dallas in order for Dallas insurance. The whole Texas is one market, right? So our insurance goes up. So the problem with these two is now your expense ratio is high. On a C-class property, it'll be 56, 60% expense ratio. And what will happen is now your break-even occupancy is like 80, 85%. You see what I'm saying?
Right.
So unless 80% of the people pay rent, you're not whole. You can't break even. Right? So, but there are other markets like Arizona, Colorado. There are several other markets where, like especially Colorado, their property taxes are third lowest in the country.
Wow.
So even though it looks like, oh my God, a 1960s property, it's 200 a door.
Right.
But look at your expense ratio. Your expense ratio, and the rents are high as well, right? So your expense ratio is like 26, 30%, and your break-even occupancy will be like 50%. Now, where do you want to be, especially in this climate? Do you want to buy something where, unless 80% of the people pay bill or pay the rent, you won't break even? Or where do you want to be? Or you want to be a place where 45 to 50% pays the rent and you're okay?
So are you looking at Colorado right now?
Absolutely, yeah. So my interest has peaked in those Western markets, and Las Vegas is good. Arizona, Idaho is small market, very competitive market, hard to land anything, Colorado. So that is my immediate concentration area. But I live here. I love Texas. I mean, Texas helped us where we get here. All I'm saying is that you got to find that right deal, which allows you that kind of a margin of safety.
Yeah, makes sense.
Where is the margin of safety when 80 to 85% of the people have to pay rent for you to break even? Tell me.
Yeah.
Where is
it? No, it's difficult. And, you know, one of the things that's helped some people get deals done now is, you know, interest rates have dropped dramatically. So, you know, the deal that I put together a couple of years ago, you know, our rate was like 491 and people are getting rates at plus or minus 3% now. So, you know, when you have that on 70, 75% leverage, you know, that definitely helps.
Absolutely.
Hey, talk about this. You guys have not done this before, but I've talked to you about this offline and I'm going to broach it here on the podcast as well. So almost every syndicator I know does a deal. They get a deal under contract. They have their investor database. They have 60 days to close. Then they go out and in the next 4 to 6 weeks, as they're doing the appraisal and then start the financing and all that, they're going out and raising the equity for that deal. So they're pitching the actual deal to invest in. I've invested in, I think, 9 different syndications passively. And one of them was set up as a fund. And so I actually invested money into the deal. I think I invested $100,000 into that deal. And I didn't know what assets the sponsor was going to buy. I just bought into the credibility and the track record of that sponsor. And I was buying into them that they would find the right deal. You guys have now built a stellar reputation. You've raised $80 million in equity. Have you guys ever considered, you know, going the fund route versus the deal specific route?
Absolutely. Like everybody, we were thinking of actually starting a fund as soon as COVID hit. Because what we thought is, just like everybody, that there will be some fire sale, right? Like, oh my God, right. So much distressed property is going to come way. See, in order to set up a fund, there should be a reasonable expectation of the product to come your way. And again, we are again, let's say if you're back in 2008, 2009, oh, we know everywhere there's distressed fire sales. Yeah, makes sense. You know, we don't want to syndicate for every single deal when time is of the essence, where you have to seize the opportunity. If you have fund money sitting there, discretionary funds, you can go get it. Now, we thought that's the same thing, which is going to happen post-COVID. And we talked to our lawyer, preliminary discussions, you know, back of the napkins and all that. But where is the distressed properties? Not in multifamily.
They're not there.
It's not there.
Right.
I haven't seen one.
No.
I've seen a couple of syndicators advertising that it's a COVID deal. They got a 5% discount or something like that. But that's not the distress I'm talking about.
No, right.
There's not none. So immediately with that, our interest in starting the fund kind of
dissipated. You know, right.
Dissipated. But had I been a hotelier, probably it still makes sense for me to start a fund, because I think there are some transactions. I think there's some reasonably some distressed properties in hotel, not retail, but hotel, where you can get your hands on some distressed properties.
Right.
So that's our.
So you think the fund is best suited for distressed opportunities. Now, what happens in this scenario when the economy goes into a tailspin? Now, all of a sudden, you know that there are going to be distressed deals available, but your investor base is scared also. And so they don't want to release their money because they have money in stock market, they have money in different investments, and they're worried about, they may be worried that they're going to lose their job. And, you know, for all those different reasons, you know, it may be more difficult to raise money.
Absolutely. No doubt about it, right? The retail investor, that funds are available to you only as long as there is a reasonable expectation that the economy will be okay, right? We cannot be on a downward trend. So if you think about it, the beauty of the COVID is the downturn happened like that.
Oh my gosh. It was crazy.
But if it goes like slowly over a year, well, it's a problem, right? Investors don't like that. Don't catch the falling knife kind of a saying, right?
Right.
So it happened, the downturn happened so quickly that it spared us that problem. Okay, somebody hit us on the face, we're on the floor, we know what we had to get up. That's the kind of situation we all found ourselves, and we quickly lost 25 million jobs, and we made a lot of recovery. So that kept the retail investors' enthusiasm in the market. Now, if there is a double dip recession, sure, the retail investor may not invest. I completely agree, because they are scared for their job and they want to hang on to their dollars. Completely understood. And I would do the same. And that is when you have to look New York, right? So we're already talking to several,
single family players.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. There's no shame in that, yeah, right? I mean, you gotta hit the bet. They're hard to work with. No doubt about it, right? I mean, it's like, you know, heads I win, tails you lose kind of thing, But you got to build rapport with them, so that, because that is when you'll find the real gems, right? The real three baggers, four baggers and all that, right? So what do you do? So you got to look New York and.
So you're already planning for that. So that's very smart. Now, you talked about moving towards, you know, single family and also construction. What about other asset classes? Are you still focused on multifamily, or will you look at, you know, industrial has been really hot, and, you know, hospitality and, you know, some, I know retail really hasn't got hit, but it is getting impacted for sure. You know, do you see more opportunities coming in those, maybe some of these other asset classes that you may branch off, or are you going to stay in your box, the multifamily box?
No, see, that's the thing. Like earlier I said, right now my criteria is not multifamily or that or this, whichever provides the maximum margin of safety, right? And I see that construction, I get a plenty of margin of safety because there is this crazy demand for this class A properties from institutions. They don't cash flow really well after you sold it, right, for the buyer, but they don't care. As long as they make the 3%, the institutions are all over it. The other day I saw in our Addison, in CoStar, there is an article, so-and-so company bought an Addison class A property. And I said, okay, who are these guys? They're Lebanese private equity fund. Where is Lebanon? Where is Dallas? What are they doing here? Well, right?
Holy cow.
Right. So this is how it is that private equity institutions, pension funds and all that, they're looking for this class A property. So I see a greater margin of safety at the class A construction, not luxury. Again, there is a distinction, right? Again, if you want to build in the CBD in the downtown with all the bells and whistles, I'm not saying that it won't work, but now you are obviously increasing the risk profile and the risk to reward issue is not that favorable. But if you build something for $1,300 rents in Texas, 20-minute driving distance from CBD on or very close to a major highway, that's your class A property. You'll get class A tenants, but it's not luxury at all. It's not low income either, right? So that is the sweet spot I want to be in. And I think that is the spot which presents me a greater risk to reward ratio. So that's one aspect. Single family is another thing. And now we have to start. I cannot do everything, right? I only have 24 hours like everybody. So I'm open to partnering with people who are experts in that area and bring those opportunities to our investors. And we'll be co-GPing that. Full operations control and the whole nine yards, right? It's not just writing them a check, but rather.
Sure.
And that gives me an opportunity to learn that business also.
Absolutely.
Right. So that is, so single family is one of the things.
You're doing that right now, right? You're doing a new build construction multifamily deal.
Absolutely. And one of my partner in one of these construction deals is a 65-year-old veteran with 40 years of industrial experience. And I get a front row seat to learn their business on.
That's awesome. I mean, look, you know, listeners, it doesn't stop. The learning doesn't stop, you know, like he surrounded himself with syndicators. He did his first deal in Oklahoma. He moved to, you know, back into Dallas and learned from them. But now, look, he's got 3,000 plus units. He's raised $80 million and he's still looking to learn from other people that have more experience.
And it's all cycles, right? We know that real estate is cycle. Every asset class is on its cycle. So we cannot be just thinking it's the same game every day. No, we have to pivot. We have to always pivot and do what gives us most margin of safety and a favorable risk to reward ratio. And right now that is construction. Maybe 5 years from now, it may not be construction. Maybe then we'll go back to our B and C class properties. But today I see a better favorable risk to reward ratio with construction with this insatiable demand for the new product.
Awesome. Venkat, what do you do outside of work for fun?
So I'm a history buff. So I watch a lot of, so it's my understanding that, I want to understand what happened from the Big Bang till now. So that aspect, that's geography, that's history, that's biology, that's astrophysics. So I spend most of my time in learning bits and pieces of this thing and put it all together in my mind, which takes up about 60% of my free time, right? I'm a great courses member. So I like learning. And I do a little bit of gardening. I have a very small garden at home. And then I have two pups and I give the rest of time to them.
Fantastic. Well, Venkat, you have a ton of knowledge, a ton of experience, and you guys keep pushing the bar. So what is the next big stretch goal for you guys?
Well, for my personal goal is to do more of this construction loan, master that and develop the relationships and all that. And I would like to see myself building about 3,000 units. And I don't have time
on the construction. On the construction side. So you have over 3,000 on the BC side. Now add another 3,000 on the new construction side.
That's my immediate goal, yes.
Just a small goal.
I didn't time bound it. Again, I want to be very realistic with this COVID. I will time bound it. It's not just that I don't want to arbitrarily pick a number out of the thin air and put it there, because I want it to be a stretch goal, but still attainable.
Sure. Yeah. So if listeners want to reach out to you and get to know you better, what's the best way for them to contact you?
Well, they can call me at 281-727-9238. That's my cell phone number. Or they can email me at Venkat, V-E-N-K-A-T, at ravenmultifamily.com. And while you're at it, please visit our website at ravenmultifamily.com. One word.
Listeners, these guys are top notch. I'm invested in two of their deals. They're just good guys and have blown up the space, and they have big hearts to help other people. And so I love that, and I really appreciate the relationship. Listeners, I hope you enjoyed that one. Venkat, thank you for all your wisdom. And until next week, sign off.
Thank you for listening to Darren Batchelder's Real Estate Investing Show at darrenbatchelder.com. If you liked the episode, please provide us with a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or your podcast platform of choice. If you already provided us with a 5-star review, then thank you, and please share the show with a friend.